April 22nd, 2024, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Please silence all cell phones. Members present today are Senator Kawasaki, Senator Vice Chair Willikowski, Co-Chair Giesel, myself, Senator Bishop, Senator Dunbar, Senator Kaufman, and Senators Klayman will be along shortly. I'd like to thank our, we got a new, Juliana is here. All right on. Good to see you. And Mr. Williams is here behind the curtain. So up today, 104, HB 104 timber sales by Representative Kronk and HB 50 carbon storage by the governor. And I look to Senator Giesel for a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee adopt Senate CS for House Bill 104, Work Order 33 LS0474/Y as our working document.
Thank you. And I'll object for the purposes of discussion. Ms. Ritkers, would you go through the changes, please?
Thank you. For the record, Ann Ritkers, staff to Senator Click Bishop. Before you should be the explanation of changes document for House Bill 104. We're moving from version D to version Y. The first changes are in Section 3 regarding salvage sales. Added language expanding opportunities for timber that has lost or within 2 years will lose economic value because of the effects of fire or fire suppression. We also added language to prevent the spread of bugs to adjacent stands. We removed language expanding salvage opportunities for timber that, if harvested, would prevent surrounding timber from losing economic value because of fire. In Section 4, which is negotiated sales, we added language to allow that sales may be sold below appraised value but above base rate. The above base rate is the new part there. Also added language for the division to review an existing contract stumpage rates periodically. And added language that in the event that multiple operators are interested in the same negotiated sale, the division could move that sale to a competitive bid process under AS 3805120. The final changes are in Section 6, which is a reporting requirement to the legislature. We set a time frame, clarified what types of sales to include, and other technical changes.
Thank you. Let the record reflect we're full staff. Senators Kaufman and Senator Klayman are with us, and I did tell the viewing public that you guys are en route. So, okay. Any questions to the committee changes? I'll remove my objection if there's none. With that, I look to Senator Giesel for a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Committee Substitute for House Bill 104, Work Order 33, LS0474/Y, out of committee with individual recommendations and forthcoming zero fiscal note.
Thank you. Seeing no objections, this bill will be moved out of committee with individual recommendations and forthcoming zero fiscal note. Seeing with that being said, we are going to take a brief of these while we sign the bill document and switch gavels. We're at ease.
back on the record. We are now to our second item of business, House Bill 50. This is carbon storage by the governor. This is the first hearing of this bill. Our committee has held 7 hearings on its companion, Senate Bill 49. So today the department is here, and I will invite Haley Payne, who is the Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, Department of Natural Resources, and John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. So the department today will give us a refresher on the bill and walk the committee through the changes that were made in the House. Also available for questions, committee members, here in the room, Brett Huber is the chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And online, there are lots of folks. There's 4 people. Marwin Wartes, Chief Energy Resources Section, Division of Geologic and Geophysical Surveys. Chris Wallace, Petroleum Engineer, Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Dan Stickle, Chief Economist, Tax Division, Department of Revenue, and Mary Gramling, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. So all 4 of these folks are also available for questions as we go along. So, welcome, Deputy Commissioner and Director. Please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair Giesel and members of the committee. For the record, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner at DNR here. We're very appreciative of the committee's time to discuss this important bill. Senator Giesel, as you just referenced, on the companion legislation, we've had a number of hearings, so a lot of information about the topic and how CCUS functions and the different dynamics in Alaska. This presentation today, we're going to give a very quick summary of both the bill itself and some of the changing and evolving dynamics that we think make this an even more important opportunity for the state, but really focus on the changes to the legislation from the Senate version that we saw in the House. Both the House Resources Committee and the House Finance Committee saw some amendment activity that changed a couple of important provisions of the bill. We think very functionally that the bill achieves the goals and opportunities that we'll describe in a slide here. But of course, welcome the Resources Committee's review and look forward to answering your questions and discussing. So I'll turn it over to Deputy Director Payne to take us away.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. For the record, my name is Haley Payne. I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Oil and Gas at the Department of Natural Resources. And yes, I'll be walking us through this presentation. I think Deputy Commissioner Crowther already lined this up quite well. As we move through the slides, there'll be a number of references to the sections of the bill, and I'll provide some page and line numbers as well. This information will be on the version D that was referred over here from the House. So just quickly to reorient with the purposes of HB 50. So what we're talking about today is carbon capture, utilization, and storage. Essentially, this is just a catch-all term for capturing CO2 off industrial processes, cleaning, dehydrating, and then ultimately transporting and storing that into deep underground caverns. By deep underground, we're talking relatively about 2,400 feet is the bare minimum that these things will be injected to. But most likely, you're seeing a lot of locations that inject 5,000, 6,000 feet below the surface here. So quite a significant distance from our groundwater sources as well. Under this bill, we're going to see 2 agencies that are empowered through it. This is going to be the Department of Natural Resources. Will act as the function as a landowner and would seek to license and lease the state's pore space or the microscopic holes within the grains of sand for which you can inject CO2. We would also handle the right-of-way leases for carbon dioxide transportation pipelines. The other agency that is authorized through this legislation is going to be the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Just as they do with our current oil and gas structure, they would be in charge with regulating the geologic storage of carbon dioxide and also protecting the subsurface mineral rights and correlative rights of property interest owners. And without any other questions, I'll advance to the next slide.
Seeing none, I'll let you proceed.
Great. So we're here on slide 3. So one of the components that has really been emphasized both last year and this year is sort of talking about that timing piece as it comes to this legislation. There are a number of factors that are sort of converging both nationally and internationally as it pertains to CCUS. One of those big drivers that we'll mention again here later in the presentation is the 45Q tax credits. And so these are federal government incentives to encourage folks to capture and store CO2. One of the primary timing considerations of those 45Q tax credits is they are only available for entities that begin construction on a CCUS facility by January 1st, 2033. And these projects can take about 5 to 7 years in terms of their development before they're actually able to store CO2. On the right here, there is a little bit of a feedstock from Senator Lisa Murkowski. Already in this state, we're seeing a number of entities that are being awarded grants to the Department of Energy that were also supported by the Investment Infrastructure and Jobs Act. And this represents some of the growing interest for various industry partners already present here in Alaska. This references a direct air capture feasibility study that we have a consortium of ASRC Energy Services, Repsol, and Santos, who are both operating interest donors here in Alaska, as well as Storega, who is an international company that's doing a lot of work to develop CCUS projects overseas. On the global scale, one of the other notations that we've talked a little bit about is this idea of the global marketplace for transporting and storing CO2. Just recently, there was an official delegation from Japan that came to do a state dinner at the White House, and one of the many topics that was discussed that day is highlighted at the top. And just the U.S. sort of committing to continue to evaluate this sort of cross-border exchange specifically between Japan and Alaska. And I think when we first started to present this concept to you all, we talked very much about the conceptual idea of these CO2 tankers that can transport CO2 long distances. And we're starting to see those go from just concept designs into actually being ordered and designed and built as ships. And so this other article from the Wall Street Journal references that there's four which are sort of being developed right now that will be available by 2025 and 2026 to actually do this sort of cross-border exchange.
Any questions on this slide? I have one. Okay, I'll start with you, Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair, to Ms. Payne. Are these the transshipping design where I know there's been previous discussions where they could ship liquefied carbon dioxide in one direction and then ammonia or some other product in the other direction? Has it gotten that far, or is this really just purpose designed for CO2?
Yes, Senator Kaufman, through the chair. So these tankers are specifically just for the one direction. They are just for design for the transportation of CO2.
Thank you.
All right. Deputy Director, so there are actual Alaska citizens that listen into these meetings. I send the recordings out on a newsletter. And the questions I get back is, why are we doing this? So could you articulate, is the 45Q credits don't come to us. Why should we care what Japan wants? How does this benefit the state of Alaska? Do we really believe we're being inundated with CO2? These are the kinds of questions I'm getting asked. So how would you simply explain why we're doing this?
Thank you, Chair Giesel. John Crowther, for the record. I'll take a crack at it, and I'm sure Haley can do it more simply, and I'll probably give you a long-winded answer. I think there's two kind of very simple distillations. The first is that driven by 45Q, driven by international requirements, people are seeking to invest money in these kind of projects. And when you invest money in a project, whatever the broader activity that occurs is people work on that project, it operates in a locality, it's long-term jobs, there's economic benefits there. So in a place like Alaska where we have the geology and people are looking to invest money in these kind of projects, we want to have that for that reason alone. Project goes forward, Alaskans have jobs, we have a diversified industrial activity. I think the next kind of tier of obligation almost to pursue this is to generate revenue for the state. We have a valuable resource in our pore space that's not being utilized at all right now. And if people are investing money in projects and trying to develop them, and we have an opportunity to gain some revenue, any revenue, or even a lot of revenue, we want to make sure that we think we're obligated at the Department of Natural Resources. This is a natural resource to see that development. So that's an important consideration as well. And I'd finally note that you know, in our existing industries, mining, you know, kind of a third point, I said there were two, mining, oil and gas, all the things that are occurring in Alaska today, driving economic activity, driving state revenue, carbon management is an increasing consideration of the investors for those folks. And so if we want to see billions of dollars go into the North Slope, those investors are saying we want to see some carbon management solutions as close to the activity as possible. And so we've seen that particularly with Santos, multi-billion dollars into the Pika project, but also looking very closely at CCUS in Alaska. And so we think that that's a huge value for the state long-term. If we can see billions more in our existing industries, that we absolutely need to be setting that up for that success. So, you know, that short answer I'd say, you know, for people watching is there's economic benefits of just having employment and activity, there's direct state revenue, and there's value potentiation and maximization of our other resources. So all those are good for Alaskans.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. On that note, can you give us some degree of the magnitude of revenue that we might anticipate? I'm looking at the fiscal notes, and I see one for $888,000, but then $738,000 after that every year, and then the rest are zeros, and then there's an indeterminate. Do you have any idea what kind of range we could expect from this?
Yes, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, John Crowther again here. I think we presented, I believe, a little bit to the Senate Resources Committee, but we can refresh that information about some scenarios of development and the kinds of scale of revenues that we could see. If we were to see some small in-state projects with existing emission sources or new in-state energy generation, the kinds of fees associated with that would be in the millions, potentially tens of millions of dollars in revenue, which is, you know, a meaningful contribution to the state revenue in addition to the in-state energy generation. Were we to see something like the Alaska LNG project or large-scale emissions injection from North Slope activities, you know, very significant in-state use, we might see even more revenue still, just at a kind of gross conceptual level, tens of millions to maybe hundreds of millions. And then if we were to see something like the importation of CO2 in a large scale from Japan, South Korea, other jurisdictions, we expect kind of a step up still of revenue associated with that. So it's very, each one of those different kinds of concepts has a lot of development challenges, uncertainty about how that could be applied in Alaska. We think that this legislation is kind of to open the door is critical to have developers start evaluating that. But that's roughly the scale, sir.
Senator Wilikowski, Dan Stickle is online. That's the Department of Revenue. And, of course, we know that the administration has Gaffney Klein on contract for modeling. So is that kind of the data you were looking for, perhaps?
If I could. I think so, and maybe Mr. Stickle can talk a little bit about the – and I don't know if this is the appropriate time, but since we're talking about fiscal notes. The revenue fiscal note does say CCUS projects could potentially impact revenues from oil and gas production tax, oil and gas property tax, and corporate income tax, petroleum and non-petroleum. And I'm just curious what sort of impacts, negative impacts, we might see.
Is that a question for Mr. Stickle or Deputy Director Crowther?
Probably Mr. Stickle.
Okay. Mr. Stickle, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. And Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, so the question is about potential revenue impacts from passage of House Bill 50. So our fiscal note was written as an indeterminate fiscal note because there are potential impacts that could be positive or negative. The House Bill 50 would decouple the state from the 45Q tax credit that is currently available against the state's corporate income tax. So to the extent that projects proceed, they would otherwise be able to claim that 45Q tax credit. That would actually be a positive to state revenue, that we would be no longer allowing that credit. The impacts to other taxes, which would be production tax, property tax, corporate income tax, and then as well as royalties, are really, it's really hard to say. So you have some projects out there in oil and gas industry in particular where they're actually looking to couple an oil and gas development with a carbon capture project. And to the extent that we have a solid framework for doing that in Alaska, this could actually be a positive to investment and production and lead to increases in revenues from the various taxes and royalties that we collect from that production. On the other hand, to the extent that those investments trigger additional lease expenditures against the oil and gas production tax, there could be a short-term negative impact there. So tying all those together are why we've listed this as an indeterminate revenue impact.
Mr. Sickle, just a little housekeeping. Could you identify yourself for the record?
Sure. I apologize for that. Dan Sickle, I'm Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue.
Great. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski, further follow-up? Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. And I don't know who can answer this, but how contingent is the state on these 45Q credits for it to be economic for a company to use CCUS technology?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, John Crowther here. I'll take a stab at that one. From the state perspective, we're not contingent on 45Q at all, in the sense that we want to make our resources available, and who and how and why projects are developed is up to the private market, obviously driven by the incentive vis-a-vis U.S. projects. For something like the international importation of carbon dioxide, those would not be receiving a 45Q, as they're not captured in the domestic U.S. jurisdiction, not necessarily a federal U.S. taxpayer. And so other mandates or incentives might be driving those projects. But from the state's perspective, it's reasonable to say that the private developers who are pursuing these projects within the U.S. are being driven in a major way by the 45Q. So it's the driver, but the legislation doesn't make the state kind of dependent on that consideration. We're offering a commodity that people need to have in order to pursue projects, if that answers your question.
Follow-up, Senator Kosar.
Follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Then I guess my next question would be, does the state have any liability if the 45Q tax credits were taken and on behalf of a company, they were able to defray costs of doing CCUS within the state? Might be a question for somebody at tax division. Maybe Mr. Stickle.
Sure, Mr. Stickle, would you like that question repeated, or did you get it?
This is Dan Sickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. So if I understand the question, it has to do with differentiating CCUS costs from other lease expenditure costs?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And so we would anticipate developing some regulations to fully implement this. But under current law, we have a pretty robust definition of lease expenditures. And under current law in general, enhanced oil recovery type activities would be a lease expenditure. A carbon capture facility independent of an enhanced oil recovery project would not be a lease expenditure. And again, potential for some new regulations there to kind of really button up where you draw the line between the two of those.
Sure. Thank you. I guess maybe we'd like to just chat a little bit more offline on ensuring that a developer of a facility couldn't then double dip, essentially, I guess, using both the federal 45Q credits and then using the current in-state tax regime I think we'd need that clarification. Thanks.
Senator Kawasaki, as we go forward through the altered bill, I think that subject will come up. But I don't want to forget before we complete today's hearing that I would like to request any modeling DNR might have gotten from your consultant, Gaffney Klein. That would be helpful.
Senator Chair Giesel, We'd be happy to share some of the materials that Gaffney Klein as a consultant for us has developed about this concept, kind of some of the market dynamics, value dynamics, and we can additionally share some of the scenarios that the department has worked with that information to kind of present and discuss. We don't have modeling in the sense of expected revenue streams at different variables, just because today there is no CCUS in Alaska, and it's what we've done is scenario planning as opposed to modeling. Maybe it's just a semantic difference, but we'd be happy to share that with the committee.
That'd be great. So Gaffney Klein didn't take into account what would need to be done in terms of these lease expenditures or how they would play in different scenarios. I mean, sometimes consultants have done that for us in the past.
Chair Giesel, John Crowther for the record. I do not believe Gaffney has modeled expected lease expenditures under development scenarios for the department. And I think that's not to speak for him, but Dan Stickle just was referencing that there's a framework to identify under today's law and today's regulations about what is a lease expenditure and what isn't, particularly as it goes to capture and storage from a pure sequestration perspective. It's not a lease expenditure. So that the area that is the kind of question, I guess you could say, is projects who are developing, do more projects occur that result in enhanced oil recovery that is a valid lease expenditure today, and what are the revenue metrics associated with that? We've done some conceptual analysis that those are likely positive basically in most scenarios, but that's kind of a scenario plan, not a model. But we'd be happy to share that with the committee and follow up on that. It's an important discussion.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. That'd be good. No other questions on this slide. I'll let you proceed.
Thank you. Again, this is Haley Payne for the record, and we are going to be on slide 4. So this just quickly sort of encapsulates everything that is in the bill as it pertains to the various agency responsibilities. And so AOGCC has a bit of a dual function. As was passed last year in SB 48, the carbon offsets bill, AOGCC will be seeking Class 6 well primacy from the EPA. And what that means is that AOGCC would be responsible for implementing the Class 6 rule or the regulations specific to carbon storage wells here in the state. The second role that AOGCC serves is also their current one here with an oil and gas context, is that as the subsurface regulators it pertains to property rights, mineral interest, and sort of ensuring those protections. The EPA Class 6 rule does not get into things like property rights, but the AOGCC would also take on that function as well, just as they do currently. The commonalities between SB 49 and HB 50, AOGCC would be issuing the storage facility permits. There's provisions for providing public notice and hearings, and then some other provisions, including a carbon storage facility administration fund, which basically operates the same as the regulatory cost charge does presently. And what that means is that the operators of the facilities would be responsible for paying the administrative costs for the agency to take on these responsibilities. And then finally, they'd be reviewing and issuing site completion certifications, which we'll have quite a bit more discussion on as we move into some of the later slides that talk about some of the technical amendments that were made from the EPA feedback. On the other side, we have DNR will be represented as the landowner. And so this is in the functions that we have today where we would license or lease pore space on behalf of the state, and also get into the regulation of CO2 pipelines as well. In another instance, DNR would be sort of representing the state as a whole as a sovereign in terms of administering a post-closure trust fund and performing long-term managing and maintenance. DNR would be empowered to be able to, after the regulatory responsibilities have closed through AOGCC, if there's still a remote monitoring station or anything at the site anywhere in the state, DNR would be able to continue to check on that and make sure everything is performing its function. So those are the two roles of DNR under this legislation.
Thank you, Vice Chair, Co-Chair Bishop. Question?
Yes, Ms. Payne touched on it. Can you just give us a quick update where we're at on our certification process timeline?
Sure, I can give a quick update. I think I also have our representative expert, the Chairman Hubert, here in the audience as well. But as I understand it, there have been there have been some staffing, so they have brought up one carbon program officer at this point in time, and they're still hiring for their engineer, and then have already started efforts on the regulatory crosswalk. They've been able to move that in concert with the statutory review, and have had initial meetings with both EPA Region 10 and also with EPA headquarters. And I think Chairman Hubert was just there last week talking with them and telling them when they could anticipate our application for primacy, which would, of course, be dependent on the rest of this bill passing, as this provides the statutory framework necessary for that regulatory crosswalk.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good. Further questions on this slide? Seeing none. Oh, did you have some?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, John Crother, I would just note that we'll see some changes to the bill that have been made based on EPA feedback to accelerate, hopefully, that process that we'll go through in more detail on the next couple slides.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Klayman.
Are those EPA changes in the CS that we have in front of us, or are these changes you're suggesting?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, those are in the CS today, and we at this time do not have any additional EPA-derived changes, but of course we're continuing to conduct that exchange and review through AOGCC.
Thanks. Good. Next slide.
Okay. Thank you. Again, Haley Payne for the record, and we're moving on to slide number 5. So this slide here will summarize all of the changes that were made when it was before the House Resources Committee. There were a couple of committee substitutes before House Resources, as well as a few different amendments that were passed. I'm going to briefly go through these, and then I have a couple of the follow-up slides that dig into a little bit more detail on some of these. So first off, the policy statements for AOGCC and DNR were removed. The sections 15 and 32 of the bill originally had just sort of sweeping policy statements about the role of the agency as it pertains to carbon storage, and these were removed by legislative legal drafting changes. One of the other committee substitute changes was on that second bullet there, which was to modify and update some of the language that discusses the Carbon Storage Trust Fund. So this is the fund that is set up for long-term monitoring and maintenance and sort of post-site care. The changes that were made here were to prevent the fund from being susceptible to the constitutional budget reserve sweep, and also to condense it into one fund. I think it had been bifurcated into an earnings and an administrative fund, and so they just linked it as one and added some language specifically to the version in front of you on page 2. Lines 18 through 22 are the provisions that they added for the CBR portion of it. One of the other changes that was noted is the exemption from the use of 45Q tax credits against the state's income, the state corporate income tax liability. And so there is a new section to the bill, section 37, that separates this. So for reference, the state adopts the federal code by reference, and this just made it clear that Alaska will not be offering its own share of 45Q as well. The fourth bullet has to do with the Department of Environmental Conservation. They currently do have a role in terms of regulation of pipelines throughout the state. In fact, within our state pipeline coordinator's office, there is a liaison role for the DEC. And so this change just updated to add CO2 pipelines to DEC's oversight as well. The next bullet here has to do with the commercial terms that we've discussed a little bit, and we'll go into in more detail in the next two slides. So the original bill had specific minimums for both the rental rate and for an injection charge. And under the amendment that was passed, those statutory minimums have been removed, and instead the department is directed to institute those by regulation, which must be updated every 5 years. And then finally, there's some further clarifications that has been made up on the chart here, on the slide. It says to modify AS 3805-720. I think the packets that you may have received just still said 3905-720, so I just want to let you know it is Chapter 38 that is found in. But what this does is, in an instant where you have an oil and gas operator that has a reservoir that they have been using for enhanced oil recovery using CO2, and they want to transition that into one that's just purely for carbon storage, if they are to assign or name somebody else to manage that carbon storage reservoir, that there has to be a clear accounting of the dismantlement, removal, and restoration obligations, such that what facilities or equipment are solely that for oil and gas, and what facilities and equipment are there for carbon storage, and who's financially responsible for those, and providing mechanisms for DNR to evaluate and charge bonding according to that.
Question, Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you. Director. Can you tell me how will the department know whether something is an enhanced oil recovery situation or whether it's a shut well situation, I guess? Because it's really dependent on what the price of oil is and how much it costs to inject, right?
Yes, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair. And so AOGCC currently does and would need to do injection order approvals. And so any well that's going to be utilized has to operate under an approved permit. And so that permit is going to state whether that well is being used for injection or production. And then there has the associated metering. We have monthly reports that are always up on the websites that show, you know, what exactly has been the draw out of those wells. And so if there were to be a transition, let's say, from something that's enhanced oil recovery to transition, that would have to be managed by the AOGCC through an injection order and a public process.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski, question?
Yeah. On the dismantlement, removal, and restoration obligations, is there a similar requirement that we have on TAPS for the whoever's building the pipelines and other facilities to take them down after the carbon is all sequestered and done with the project?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, these are not the only DRNR provisions that are here within the bill. On page 25, lines 12 through 18, it talks about all of the requirements at site closure, facility closure, such that the pipelines, wells, equipment, everything would have to be remediated or removed, or what is left at the approval of the department to be managed thereby. So there are other notations about where the pipelines need to come out, and the facilities have to be in such an order before the site closure facility can be issued. Does that answer your question?
I think so. Thanks.
All right, I think we're ready for next slide.
Thank you. So on our next slide here, this is slide 6, we're going to go into a little bit more on the commercial terms section. So as I noted before, the bill originally had language regarding minimum floors for both a rental rate as well as for an injection charge. Those were set at $20 per acre for the rental, and then $2.50 per ton of CO2 that's injected. And the revised language takes those out and then directs the commissioner then to establish those by regulation. This sort of flexibility is something that the administration has been really supportive of, and kind of reflects a lot of our growing understanding as we're continuing to learn more about this industry. When we set these rates initially, we had a few agreements that we were sort of working off of, and have since had a number of other states, public entities come forward and start to issue their own leases and licenses. And so we have more material now than we did before. Originally, we thought there was only sort of rental rates and injection charges, but as I'll get into a little bit later, there's actually a variety of different revenue mechanisms that we're sort of seeing across the board. It's also really important to understand is that pore space itself is not inherently valuable. It's not a commodity like oil. It doesn't have a value kind of that transcends wherever you go. Your pore space is really valued based on there's geotechnical factors. I mean, does it have the right sort of rock characteristics and properties? You know, what's your depth, your porosity, your permeability? How many other wells have ever been drilled in this area? Where are the faults themselves? And so there is a lot of information that just goes into a technical aspect to determine if your pore space even has the right characteristics for this. And the other one is those non-technical factors. A really big one is going to be your source of CO2. This drives a lot of factors, be it, you know, your cost of actually capturing that CO2 and how much of the sort of project bottom line does that eat up. But also, you know, where is that CO2? How far away is it from your actual injection site? Is that CO2 that's part of an in-state energy project where there's a lot of other ancillary benefits that go along with that? And then what's your complexity of land ownership? How many other parties is the operator having to negotiate with? And so the more that we've learned, the more complicated it has continued to become. But it is interesting to see the other states be able to negotiate. And you can see on the commercial terms, which we'll go to on the next slide, that even within a state, they value it very differently at different locations. And that's because it's based on these, you know, technical and non-technical factors that they're taking into account. The Department of Natural Resources does have experience when it comes to evaluating projects and sort of what are those monetary rates. Even for something in oil and gas where we have our minimum set in statute, the legislature has also given the ability for the commissioner to do royalty modifications based on a set of criteria, AS 3805-180J. And so the department will consider a number of factors in sort of trying to find that sweet spot of what that really is that makes the economics of the project go. We also do this for our royalty in kind sort of projects as well. And so where we're setting that rate based on what the use is for the use of the oil. And so specifically, a lot of our in-state refiners do purchase oil directly from the state. And I think regulations are more easily adaptable than statutory language changes. Pause here for questions.
Questions on this slide? Senator Wilkowski.
Did Gaffney and Klein advise the department or departments in coming up with the original commercial minimums in the original bill?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, this was not based on a recommendation from Gaffney Klein. So these original numbers were generated from some of those first agreements that we were able to see. And sort of some discussions that framed the reasonable rate as anywhere could be, I think some folks said anything from 2 to 4% of the 45Q tax credits were what some of the early movers were. And if you look at that $2.50 per ton, that was like roughly 3% of an $85 per ton charge. But then we found ourselves in a situation where you're reliant on a 45Q tax credit that versus in Alaska, where we may or may not be, you know, playing with parties that have that role. But yeah, so this was just based on the research of the department as well as Stantec, who did a peer review of other states, and they put some of that information on a paper that I think was submitted to the legislature last year.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Have you received, has the department or departments received any advice from Gaffney and Klein or other experts regarding what the commercial terms should be?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, this is John Crowther for the record. I'm not sure if we have received information from our consultant Stantec, Gaffney Klein, from our own research, from the work group, and from our participation with PCORE, the Consortium of University and Industry, about what commercial terms are being seen in different projects. We haven't received advice to set a particular term, if that's an answer to your question. I think it's been more of an information gathering, and the conclusion that we came to as a synthesis of all that information is that the flexibility allows this to be iteratively developed through a public regulatory process as opposed to being set fixed in law and then and potentially missing what evolves in the market. And I would note back to some of the information we've gathered about these agreements has come to us in the last several months while the legislature has been in sessions. And so those different updates that we received last year as to the status, we continue to see evolution in the market.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
And my concern is, if we pass this bill, we'll be setting in policy no commercial terms, leaving it to the complete discretion of the commissioner to establish minimum acceptable commercial terms. And maybe that's a good thing, maybe it's not, but we have no experts at all in the legislature on this issue. And that's probably the first time in the time that I've been here, that 18 years, that we have not had experts in something as complex as this. And so I have some concern about the fact that we have no expert. And I know it's not your problem, but would you be willing to share and make Gaffney and Klein Would you be able to share the work product that you've received from your experts regarding commercial terms and other aspects of this bill with the legislature?
Senator Wilikowski, I would endeavor to share all the different work product that we have. I believe our GAFNI Climb products are all subject to sharing. Some of them may have commercially sensitive material in them, but I think we have a variety of things that we'd be happy to share.
And
Senator Wilikowski.
And so it's GAFNI and Klein, and I think you said Stantec. Would you be willing to make them available to come and testify before us and bring that work product with them?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, we would have no reservation in doing so. We'd have to confirm the status of those contracts and just make sure that we continue to have budget and contractual relationships. But we'd work to support that and make that available however we could, yes.
If I might add for the record, Haley Payne, Senator Wilikowski through the chair. Some of the underlying information in the next slide is gleaned from all of the public documents of the various leases that are out there, and be happy to share that. It has links to all of those leases, so we have links to all the public spaces where that information is coming from as well.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
In Section 15 is where you establish this commercial terms provision. It says the commissioner shall establish in regulation minimum acceptable commercial terms. Would you object to adding a provision that said something like that are in the best interests of the state or require a best interest finding?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, not at all. We believe that obligation is inherent, but clarifying it in the context of that specific determination might further confirm that the intent there is to act in the best interest of the state and maximize value. So we would not object to that kind of change. I'd also note, as you alluded, both the regulatory process itself, but then the subsequent findings of particular licenses would be subject to a public process as well, so thus transparent legislative oversight and public involvement. So we do anticipate, if in the bill in its current formulation, the commissioner's discretion as exercised would be subject to public review, both at setting the regulatory minimum, but then at the specific terms that were offered for any particular project. So.
All right, no further questions. Oh, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I also kind of had some concerns about the minimums and just that the minimum rentals and injection charges will amount to the money that's being spent to sort of administer the entire CCUS program. I don't think I have much of a problem with having a commissioner decide that, but I just wanted to hear maybe a little bit more on that. And then I've got a second question about the Clean Air Protection Fund.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Kawasaki. Through the chair, I'll answer the question in two ways. Not to speak for the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, but at a high level, the AOGCC costs are assessed and recouped from operators through the regulatory cost charge mechanism, analogous to what's currently done for their operations vis-a-vis oil and gas. And so that's the fee amounts that would be assessed with covering the cost of the program. From the landowner Department of Natural Resources perspective, we do not anticipate incurring new costs to manage the program, at least at its current scope and outlook. And that's because we have existing subsurface and leasing expertise in the department that can be applied. And so our expected fiscal note and cost there is zero. So any of the revenues would be net to the state and not attributed particularly to the program under the legislation and the fiscal notes at this time.
Follow up, Senator Kosoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then so things like well delineations and things like that that are done by either DNR or the industry itself, those costs would be borne by the industry in the end, and the state would recoup those costs, is what you're saying.
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, if I understand the question correctly, were a project proponent to attempt to delineate areas, do exploration activities, there would be their obligation to fund those. There wouldn't be any cost recovery or rebate or reduction from the state.
And then, follow-up, so the follow-up is this: is if the state has to, before it releases those particular pore spaces, does its own analysis just to reconfirm those types of analyses are going to be paid for by the company themselves or attributed to the company themselves? I don't know that we have in here a mechanism by which we decide this is how much pore space we have to offer. So that's why I'm asking.
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, and apologies if I misunderstood the question. As to the department's ability to kind of assess what we have, what's a good area to lease, are these proposed exploration activities reasonable based on what's there? That's the kind of expertise that we have today within the Division of Oil and Gas that is familiar with characterizing reservoirs. We believe that same staff could be allocated to these kind of projects without requiring the need for either new PCNs or budget at this time. And to be perfectly transparent, if we saw 100 projects come forward, we might come back to the legislature and seek additional funding and PCNs, but then we'd be able to say it's associated with this discrete activity. The amount of activity, you know, even a large major project or two, we believe we could manage with existing staff.
And then another question?
Yes, follow-up, Senator Kawasaki.
Separate, actually, was just more about when we were talking about sort of the factors in which a company might want CO2 to be sequestered here in the state. Mentioned something like transportation distance, things like proximity to infrastructure, complexity of land ownership. Is it anticipated that we'll have a company from Canada, for instance, say we want to sequester carbon dioxide in the state of Alaska and pipeline it to us? Or is it more reasonable to think that it's going to be a company currently existing within the state, takes advantage of the 45Q credit, takes advantage of the commercial terms under this bill?
Yes, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, I'll try and concisely answer. I believe it's the department's expectation that what we're seeing across the industry, across the country and the world, is that transportation is the major cost for projects. And so the areas that have great geology are benefited if they are able to have emission sources that are sourced right there. Even areas with great geology where they don't have significant emissions and they're receiving agricultural emissions that are transported via pipeline, those projects can be challenged because of the transportation costs. So we think that most of our emission sources would either be domestic, small in-state power generation, existing oil and gas operations, or potential new expansions of in-state industrial activity like large innovative fuel development and other things, or ammonia production associated with Alaska LNG, that kind of forward-looking, and then imported via vessel that's sequestered very close to the docking location. That would be focused on Cook Inlet in our estimation. So something like pipeline transportation from Canada or even across large stretches with domestic production of emissions is not expected.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski.
Have you or any of the departments in the administration or any of your consultants done any hypothetical models of what projects might look like? For example, I can envision a Cook Inlet project with an import component from Asian market, let's say. I can envision a utility hypothetical model. I can envision a North Slope hypothetical model that calculates what the internal rates of return might be, the net present values might be. Have you done any sort of analysis like that so we can get a general idea of what sort of revenue we're looking at, what sort of terms might be favorable or disfavorable?
Yes, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we have done some kind of conceptual models like that. We'd be happy to share with the committee. So the short answer is yes, we have, and we'd be happy to share. They touch many of those same kind of concepts that you just discussed. One of the things I would note is that very often the revenue, most of our hypotheticals involve the revenue stream being the 45Q, so we kind of know what the revenue amount is. Depending on the scope and scale of the injection, you just multiply it for the total revenue, and you have to fit all of the costs within that kind of total revenue, somewhat different than other projects that have variable revenue on the back end. And so we'll be happy to share that with the committee, and it's illustrative, we believe, how these projects today are very cost sensitive in the sense that capture cost is typically quite high. The injection cost, while not high relative to the capture cost, is a measurable amount. And that's if there is a transportation cost, that can very quickly exceed that revenue number. And so we'd be happy to share that with the committee.
Co-Chair Bishop, you had a question.
I do. Could you, Mr. Crowthers, could you help me with how you ascertain how much volume you could put in a reservoir space? It was going back to your answer a few minutes ago on staffing levels as it pertains to physical numbers. So I'll just talk for a minute. I would think that if you're looking at a depleted reservoir of a Cook Inlet gas field, is it one for one? You can, you know, a unit of gas and a unit of carbon going back in, you got good data on that. And let's say you're looking at, do you use 3D modeling on a piece of virgin ground to ascertain in a reservoir how much volume you could put in there? Can you help me with that?
Yeah, Senator Bishop, through the chair, I would be overstepping my expertise, which at times doesn't stop me, but on this one, I think I would, just for the benefit of the time of the committee, either Marwan Wartes or the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission gentleman online might be able to just give a quick summary of.
And if not, you can get back to the committee, because I want to be respectful of our time and how many slides you got left. So that can be a question you can get back to the committee on.
We have time, Ms. Co-Chair. Marwan Wartes, Chief Energy Resources Section, Division of Geologic and Geophysical Surveys. Did you hear Co-Chair Bishop's question, and could you respond?
Sure. This, for the record, this is Marwan Wartes, Chief Energy Resources at Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. Yeah, that is a good question, and I think you were on to the short answer, which is in the case of a producing oil and gas field, it is relatively straightforward because you kind of have parameters for the volume of fluids, oil, or gas that has been produced. I think when you're getting outside of that, for instance, in a saline reservoir or a coal seam or something like that, it is a little bit more problematic. But in the end, I suspect most of this is done with a model that makes some assumptions based on porosity, permeability, and sort of volume calculations. I think that's the short answer. But we could certainly get together and provide a little more thorough discussion for you, too, in writing.
Thank you very much.
Chair Giesel, I omitted to reference Commissioner Huber is right behind me, so he may be able to speak to this if you'd like.
Understood. Certainly. Commissioner Huber? You could pull up a third chair if you'd like. I think there's enough microphones there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Brett Huber. I'm the chairman of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. So I guess I would answer yes and no. Determining exactly what the quantity of pore space in any basin is going to be determined by the characteristics of the geology in that basin. So it's not as simple as a one-to-one. If gas comes out, that's how much CO2 goes in. So what you're putting back in the ground is going to be a supercritical CO2, which is going to behave somewhat differently in the rock properties than the gas that you've taken out of the rocks. So to determine either of these things is going to take all the constraints of knowing where the reservoir is, what the properties of that reservoir are, what the properties are of the product that you're putting in the reservoir, and how it's going to behave in the reservoir. So quantifying this reservoir has X amount of pore space is not generally how it's done in the industry. They usually go the other direction and say, will this reservoir accept this amount of injection? And then you figure out what your pressure fronts look like, how that that supercritical fluid moves through the pore structures and the rocks. You look at where that stuff is going to go. And from that, you can determine whether this structure will take that amount of gas or that amount of CO2. But it's seldom that you determine we have X amount of potential storage in a site. It's more if we have this much to store, will this site hold it based on that modeling? So 3D seismic's used, stratigraphic wells are used, And then all of the logs and the data that you pull from downhole are used to characterize that reservoir.
Co-Chair Bishop, follow up?
Yeah, I do. So now you've got another question. So hypothetically, if you've never stored gas how do we know how it's going to behave?
Thank you, Senator Bishop, through the chair. You know how it's going to behave because you have a catalog of properties. These rocks behave in this way. These gases or these fluids behave in this way. And it really is dependent on the modeling. So you have actual, where it's been in the ground, monitoring wells, et cetera, that are double checking what the modeling shows of those pressure fronts and the dispersal of that substance underground. And you've created a catalog of this type of rock structure does this, and this fluid behaves in this way. And then it's modeled from one site to the next. And the modeling quickly gets out of my area of expertise.
Co-Chair Bishop? All right. So you do have two other commissioners to call upon for that kind of analysis. You have a geologist and you have a petroleum engineer, I believe, on the AOGCC. Is that correct, Commissioner Huber?
It is, Madam Chair. You're absolutely correct. There's a public member, a petroleum geologist, and a petroleum engineer. And then we all also have a staff of very capable petroleum geologists and petroleum engineers, one of whom's on the line today, Mr. Chris Wallace, that does our underground injection control program for our Class 2 wells.
Co-Chair Bishop, would you like to hear from Mr. Wallace? All right. All right. Great. Thank you. Further questions on this particular slide? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, and I guess to whoever feels best able to answer this, so it was just earlier stated by Mr. Prather that the transport costs are such a factor. It just brings up some questions about the viability of shipping. It's the reason why I asked about the transshipping of a one single direction shipping from Japan. Is that as viable a prospect as it might be considering the shipping costs, or does the economy of scale simply allow that? Thank you.
Senator Kaufman, through the chair, I think that's John Crowther for the record here. I think that's a very, very prescient question. It's kind of the crux of, will that business model and industry develop due primarily to that shipping cost? What we're looking at and assessing is, I flip back to slide 3, you know, we have two strong signals that people are at least considering those concepts. One is that the actual investment and construction of those ocean-going liners to carry CO2 is occurring, which is a strong signal that industry is moving that way. And then two, we have the representation from the Japanese government that they're very interested in the market and the activity. And so while I think cracking the economic kind of formula on those projects will, of course, continue to be a major driver for them, we're seeing signs that it's being pursued in earnest. And then I'd also note that the reasons why the Japanese government or the Korean government or other international parties are pursuing these, they may have their own incentive and restriction structures separate from the U.S. domestic 45Q. But obviously, where they see the value and how they manage costs while still recouping value is ultimately the question.
Follow up.
Thank you.
Senator Kaufman. All right, I think we can go to the next slide, which is number 7, I believe.
Yes, thank you. For the record, again, this is Haley Payne, and we are on slide 7. We'll just be brief on this one. This is a summary table that looks at some of our peer states and the different leasing terms that they have offered. Essentially, sort of the brass tacks, I guess it is, on this is that there's a number of different mechanisms, both between states and even within a state, on how they approach it. So Wyoming, as a state, is not even charging rentals at this point in time. They're instead charging something called like a bonus bid, so basically a lump sum payment at different stop gates of the project. And their injection charges are about $1 per ton with escalators that track the consumer price index. The Texas General Land Office, their structure for leasing and licensing straight lands is a bit different. They issue requests for proposals on tracts they've previously identified. They had the benefit of passing their legislation back in 2009 and then spent over 5 years on detailed studies of all their different locations and specifying tracts and determining value prior to going into the market. And so they put out requests that include everything from bonus bids to portion of additional value outside of 45Q. So if there were to be some other revenue streams imagined as a part of this, like a carbon credit, as it were, they want a portion of that. And then they have injection charges on this most recent request for proposal that was at $4 per acre. And then lastly, in Louisiana, they have quite a bit of variation. They're sort of the gold rush state, as it were, at the moment, with the most number of these going in. And they have some bonus bid payments that are non-existent, up to $425 per acre. And then rental injection charges that go from $1.50 to $7.50. Interestingly, as an escalator, they sort of tie to the 45Q at that moment and see if there's been a change to increase that again by the federal government, that they get a share of anywhere from 5 to 9% of that increase in value. All of these states do individually negotiated agreements and don't currently have any minimums in statute.
So, thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Looking at the public process column, it looks like all of those states have some sort of mechanism where, for example, Wyoming, a state director of state lands, brings lease before a board of land commissioners for approval at a public meeting. The next one is Texas. There's a general land office reviews, solicitation responses, negotiates, and then there's a final approval of the school land board. Louisiana is approval by Office of Minerals Resources after a public hearing. Is there any sort of mechanism like that in our statute?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, the bill at this time does not have a specific board set up to review it. However, as the department does any best interest findings, as you articulated before, there would be that public process of putting out what those commercial terms are in a preliminary best interest finding, and then that would be open for comment as well before a final finding is issued.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
Would you have an objection to, like, a state assessment review board or some other board or commission reviewing the lease that was negotiated?
Yeah, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, this is John Crowther. I think we understand that these decisions and executions of management of the state's resources need to have public process and need to follow the constitutional mandate to maximize the development and use and value of these resources. I don't want to comment on the operation of these boards in these other states. It's our understanding that they're established boards that are very active. They have staff. They have capacity. I don't, from the department's perspective, we don't currently interact with existing state boards that oversee our decision making. And so the establishment of a new board might entail significant costs and process steps that we don't have an entity today that we can, by our understanding, kind of have performed that function. So our focus on the legislation today is the public process that's consistent with other laws and continuing to fulfill the constitutional duty. We understand why this formulation is appealing and bears kind of further examination, but that's a consideration for us of the lack of a current board that we understand could readily step into this function, and the administrative and overhead costs that would be associated with creating one.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski?
Oh, just on the other hand, as it's set up now, you have one person deciding whether these lease terms are in the state's best interest, and I think that might be better for us going forward if we had that dispersed and we had an oversight organization or a board that was reviewing these to make sure they're in the best interest of the state.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going off what Senator Wilikowski said, I was looking up to see if that school land board was an elected board. I wasn't able to find it in time. Maybe Senator Kaufman knows. But that's another thing we sort of lack. In a lot of other states, there are elected commissioners. There are elected auditors. There are elected boards that are statewide or much larger than we have here. In Alaska, we tend to sort of put everything into the executive, for better or worse, in an unelected way. I guess my question for the department would be, maybe this is a subject for a bill for the next session if it doesn't work its way into this bill, but if it had to be, if review had to be in a board, which of the boards would be most capable of doing that? You know, assuming that they had to, their authorizing statute had to be amended.
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, you know, as you noted, we don't have a wide variety of boards that oversee different department activities, and I don't want to speak to, you know, DNR has an exhaustive number of obligations under all the different natural resources, so there may be different groups or decisions that do receive some level of review from different boards outside of the oil and gas or subsurface context. I would say the only analogous one that I can think of, the Oil and Gas Royalty Advisory Board, does review and offer recommendations for royalty and kind contracts. That is a board, I believe, consisting of volunteer members with no staff. And it typically meets only when an royalty and kind contract is considered, which is sometimes there's a significant multi-year period between the consideration of those. So the board does not meet or perform any functions during those times. So it's not a standing, regularly active board. But I would say, you know, not to comment on the philosophical or structure of government elements of the debate, but, you know, we at the department do our processes with public process. We receive public input. Our decisions are subject to appeal and ultimately appeal to the courts. And we have to undertake our own obligation to the Constitution, which we take quite seriously. So we do feel that process is robust and working well across our authorities. But, of course, the legislative oversight is a function that you all have to perform, and we appreciate that as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunbar, we used to have an Oil and Gas Competitiveness Review Board that has since, sunset, but it almost sounds like it would fill that bill if we reconstitute it. All right, seeing no further questions on this page, I'll let you go to the next slide. I had one question. It looks like these are live links on this document, and this will be posted on the public site. Is that true, the blue ones that are underlined?
Yes, Chair Giesel, those are live links. And as I indicated before in our previous response, the underlying lease agreements that support this, we also have live links too that we'll submit to the committee.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, next slide is 8, I think.
Thank you again. This is Haley Payne, and now we are on to slide 8. Just being cognizant of time, I might move a little bit more quickly through these last few slides, but please feel free to interrupt with questions. So these are the changes that were made to the bill in the House Finance Committee as a part of an amendment that AOGCC and DNR worked with the committee on based on feedback we received from the EPA, as well as sort of subsequent interviews with Louisiana and other states that had just kind of done the primacy process. And so a lot of these are some technical amendments, but then they made some underlying sort of structural changes based on those. So first off, the certificate of completion default period is something that we referenced earlier. And so the bill as originally introduced called for a period of at least 10 years or until the geologic and engineering data supported the time for site closure. We have been informed by the EPA that they would like to see 50 years or until the time of the geologic and engineering data supports it. While they may be, it's kind of a different way of saying the same thing, basically it's relying on the data, they would prefer to see that number actually placed in the statute. And Louisiana, right after receiving primacy, had to pass a statute and change theirs that I think said 20 years before to say 50 years. When we introduced this bill, we were going on the best available information at the time, and both North Dakota and Wyoming, who had received primacy, had years other than 50 in there. And so that's what our statutes were originally modeled after. One of the other big changes the EPA requested to see has also been touched on, and that is the removal of the good cause exemption. And so that, again, is something that allows the experts at AOGCC to, if there is a specific regulatory requirement to evaluate the site-specific data, project characteristics, or operator plans to meet the same underlying need, even if it's not prescriptively done the same way that the regulations state. The EPA is uncomfortable with good cause exemptions and would like to see the Class 6 rule implemented prescriptively. And so that is to say that AOGCC will not have that same authority to evaluate and decide based on good cause if something can still achieve those objectives.
So you're saying that's been changed in the bill?
Yes.
All right. And it looks like it's in Section 32. Very good. Questions? Co-Chair Bishop.
Thank you. Ms. Payne, with what you just explained, does this EPA requirement on the bottom one here, 4106115, is that to sync up with their 50-year extension?
Yes, Co-Chair Bishop. So the 50-year one is actually going to be, it was updated and changed in, let's see, page 24, line 31. That is where the change to the default is. And that second one, the good cause exemption, is one that has just been stricken from the record entirely and is no longer in 4106, now 110, which are the general authorities of AOGCC. So this is two different changes that have been made based on feedback from the EPA.
Follow-up, Senator or Co-Chair? All right. Seeing no further questions. Next slide.
I would just note for the committee, John Crowther for the record, that on that same question with the striking of what I believe was 115, that the version of the slide on the screen shows that 110 AS 4106110. So that's the second of those technical corrections to the slides that may be in front of you.
So for clarification, that should be 115, not 110. Is that what you just said?
It should be 110, the version on the screen.
Oh, it should be 110. Thank you. Thank you.
And that's the last technical correction to the slide.
Thank you.
Okay, so continuing on, we're on slide 9 now. So there have been some changes to the carbon storage closure trust fund. In Section 5 is where this fund first appears. This is, as we noted earlier, there were changes to make this fund no longer sweepable and set it up as separate from the general fund. And so what this provision did is, prior to this, it included a benefactor of setting up a memorandum of understanding to schedule your payments. And so instead of working with each operator to set up individualized payment schedules under a memorandum of understanding, we have simplified this to just be an annual charge based on a straightforward calculation. And so we removed that MOU as an unnecessary step now that the statute goes into exactly how long you have to pay it on and how much it's going to be. This MOU is also sort of a remnant that is from the Mining Reclamation Trust Fund, which is what our statute was originally based on. In the mining context, that makes a lot of sense, but within this bill, given that we have a very prescriptive set formula, it no longer seemed necessary. And this also sort of directs and clarifies that both DNR and AOGCC may make expenditures under the fund on certain circumstances. And related to this carbon storage closure trust fund is going to be the facility injection surcharge. So the original version of this bill had this set by AOGCC as a part of order and was going to be a per ton fee based on all the information about the project. Here we are switching this away from this project specific to be more of a set in statute one. And so now the surcharge itself will be paid into over 12 years for a total of $7.5 million, which will be adjusted for inflation. The 12-year period was derived from, that's the duration the 45Q tax credits last, and so most projects are seeking to be in business for at least 12 years. And so that was where that figure came from. The $7.5 million project amount is derived off of Louisiana. They have $5 million per project. And so this is a bit of an increase over Louisiana, sort of recognizing some of the more of the cost of doing business here in Alaska. But also what this recognizes is that because the post-closure period has shifted to be more of a 50-year timeline, When some other states originally passed their legislation, they envisioned the sovereign helping or paying for some of the post-closure regulatory responsibilities. That's no longer on the table. The state would not be involved in any of the regulatory requirements, nor would it have any of the regulatory duties to perform. So this $7.5 million is extra and above all of the other bonding requirements of the regulations and is just a sort of set-aside insurance policy, if you will, for the state to have on hand should it elect to do any other monitoring the site after it's closed.
Any questions on this page, on this slide? All right, seeing none.
So we are on slide 10. Slide 10 discusses the title to the carbon dioxide. And so this is found on page 24 in lines 14 through 22. And so the bill is originally drafted, stated that when the certificate of completion is issued, the state through the Department of Natural Resources would take title to the CO2 in order to conduct some of the monitoring and maintenance activities. But now under this new structure, where again, there is no regulatory role at all for DNR or the state to perform. And we've also set up in this next section, another section that allows DNR to perform monitoring and maintenance without actually having to take title to the CO2. And so in this way, when it comes time to the certificate of completion, the project owner and the pore space owner would then negotiate who would be taking title to the CO2. So in instances where that pore space owner does not want to be responsible or have that subsurface title in their name, the operator would still be on the line. In instances where it's the state as the underlying resource owner, the state can take title and use this long-term monitoring and maintenance fund. And this also sort of gives that optionality because we do have a very different landowner structure here than you have in the lower 48. These funds were originally based on areas where you have the title to the pore space going to the surface owner. So you have 100 small farmers or so in an area. And so rather than having them take that on, the state would. But now within the context of here we are, and this is a mineral estate resource, we don't have nearly as many mineral estate owners, much more homogenous subsurface. This allows the option and also alleviates DNR from having to take any sort of property title or interest.
Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Director Payne. Earlier on, you mentioned the value, or maybe it was Commissioner Carruthers mentioned the value of pore space. Is there a value for CO2 in the ground, a natural value?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair. So I think that's a very sort of interesting question in terms of is CO2 thought to be a useful product? Does it have beneficial uses? Are we using it today in other industrial processes? Yes, absolutely. However, I believe the way the 45Q structure is set up is that it's supposed to be for permanent sequestration. So I think any entity that stores it in the ground would face some penalties or clawbacks if it were to then try to draw that back out and sell or produce it later.
Thank you.
So, Co-Chair Bishop.
Thank you. Just a quick one. Excuse me. What's the penalty for an inadvertent release into the atmosphere? Is there, from EPA, is there a penalty? Mr. Huber?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Bishop, the penalty provisions that we've proposed in the bill are for the same penalty provisions that we have for our oil and gas statutes, which are a $100,000 maximum and a $10,000 per day. So you can build up the fine. Does EPA have a specific penalty structure for a release into the atmosphere? I'm unaware of a specific penalty structure. They have an entire compliance division that takes a look at all of those and then makes a determination based on what their track record is. I can't share with you because I don't know what exactly their charges for releases to the atmosphere are. I'd have to get back with you on that, Senator, after doing some more research. I can tell you that our penalty provisions in the EPA's bind cover the penalties that we would need to assess an operator to meet federal guidelines. But I can't tell you what it is for a specific event or release.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Does the AOGCC have jurisdiction over the waste of gas or natural gas or carbon in this case?
Senator, through the chair, we do have jurisdiction over waste of the oil and gas resources, right? It's part of our enabling statutes in the Oil and Gas Act, or the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission Act. That waste is waste as in you're not utilizing for its benefit the product that's being produced. So for example, before metering, gas is escaping from the ground, not being metered and charged to the state. So yes, we do have that authority. CO2 in this instance, since CO2 is a constituent of our atmosphere, it's valued quite differently than something like a hydrocarbon would be. So how would we deal with waste on this? You're talking about injection, you're not producing a project. So you have a stream coming and you have an agreed facility operator that's going to inject that stream into the ground. Anything that would be spilled before it reaches ground injection, say there was some kind of, and I'm not aware how that would happen, but if there was a potential leak of the product before it went in the ground, that would be a privately held product at that point, right? Somebody has produced it and purchased it and paid to store it. So I would imagine that the waste of that product would be like if you bought a gallon of milk and you want to pour it on the ground, it's your milk to do that with. They are the owners of that product until it's in the ground.
Follow-up, so Senator Wilikowski.
On that point, if it's an oil company, let's say, on the North Slope, there's CO2 in the ground. I guess that's our CO2, right? They're and technically, they want to pull out the oil and strip out the well, I guess it's in the oil. They want to pull out the oil and pull out the CO2 off the oil. So if there were a pipeline from that were transporting that, that would be a loss to the state. I mean, it's technically our CO2. It's not going into a well and therefore earning perhaps some sort of injection fee. So that, I guess that could be considered waste.
So, Senator, through the chair, I would agree with you. If it's something that's being produced that's not been metered and the state has not received its fair compensation, then certainly it would be waste. CO2 and methane, of course, are valued very differently, and that value chain is going to look a lot different than that kind of waste determination. It would still be up to our agency to determine what is the amount of CO2 you're bringing in, what's your daily injection rate, are you meeting those daily injection rates? We would monitor all of that stuff downhole. But if you're talking about a pipeline section, then that would be the Department of Environmental Conservation's portion of this.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
Different question, and it's on the question of title again. And if a company retains title to the CO2 and they're using our well space, our pore space, I guess, would they be paying property taxes on that or some other form of taxes on that to use?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, if John Crowther here, if Dan Stickle's still online and he knows off the top of his head kind of the criteria for property assessment, the facilities associated with would be subject to property assessment as we understand them.
I can certainly call him Mr. Stickle. He is still online.
Yeah, whoever.
Mr. Stickle, did you hear the question?
So the question has to do with property assessment on CCUS.
Well, if after we're giving title to the CO2 upon completion, and so the owner is using our pore space, and so therefore I'm just curious if they're paying any property taxes or other form of taxes on that, royalties.
Sure. Yeah. And Dan Stickle, chief economist with the Department of Revenue. As far as the property tax piece of it goes, I should probably do a follow up with the committee on that just so I'm not getting out a little bit beyond my skis. I am pretty familiar with the production tax impacts in particular, where we are, you know, drawing a distinction in terms of what is a qualifying for a lease expenditure and production tax versus not, based on whether those facilities are related to an enhanced oil recovery project. But I'd be happy to follow up with some more detail on the other taxes.
All right, that sounds good. Senator Dunbar, question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We were discussing sort of where the leakage or escape might occur, and it just reminded me of the discussion we had last year. I just wanted you to refresh my mind on it just really quickly. You know, I grew up in Cordova, so I think a lot about naval disasters and spills on the water. And I'm curious, let's assume it's in Cook Inlet. That seems to be where the largest pore space is. One of these tankers you're describing has a catastrophe, and the CO2 is released. You know, what kind of environmental impacts would you anticipate, but also sort of which of these various funds would be used or would be available to contain or clean up that kind of disaster?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, this is Haley Payne for the record. Interestingly, CO2 doesn't behave like some of the other products that are out there. So once that pressure vessel that's keeping it in that supercritical space is ruptured, if you will, for lack of a better term, then that is going to quickly turn back into a gas and sort of evaporate into the atmosphere. You may have sort of almost like a dry ice consistency sort of like right away. And anywhere where CO2 is present at a highly concentrated level initially, it will, push out other molecules. So I think the way to think about that is if there's a lot of oxygen in the room and you pump much more CO2, there's going to be less oxygen space. But it also has the ability to travel very quickly. And again, since this is going to be kept at a supercritical liquid phase and then immediately sort of face that evacuation, it will likely just go into the atmosphere pretty quickly, and we won't be in this situation where, in the oil context, where you're left with something that's, on the surface or in the subsurface and remains there for quite a bit of time.
Brief follow-up.
Perhaps the gardens will grow more lushly for a few minutes. Senator Dunbar.
Would it be a Clean Air Act violation or a similar, federal law like that? Would it impact that?
So, Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I think, not to be overly lawyerly about it, but in a hypothetical, right, the ship operator could be operating negligently vis-a-vis their contractual obligations, vis-a-vis general public obligations. There could be clean. I don't believe there's criteria set for carbon dioxide in any context right now, so I'm not sure how. Again, I have no qualifications to speak to the Clean Air Act applications, but there are not federal regulations on carbon dioxide emissions today that would be triggered in that event, but it does not mean a variety of other insurance or liability or requirements to operate consistent with workplace safety laws wouldn't have been violated, depending on the specifics of the incident.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So we are now past 5 o'clock. So I am inviting you back again on Wednesday. This bill is up on Wednesday again, and I don't want to rush through any of these slides. So why don't we pause here? We can pick it back up again at slide 11. Members can – yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Just a really quick question. If there's going to be somebody from DEC to address the question that Senator Wilkowski had.
We certainly can ask for that. The other thing I wanted to ask about, Deputy Commissioner, could Gaffney Klein – and any of that Gaffney Klein material be shared on Wednesday? I don't know how nimbly that can be procured.
Chair Giesel, the department is endeavoring to be as nimble as we are physically able. So we would anticipate being able to share at least some material, if not all available material.
Okay, that'd be great. We're not going to rush through the bill, and yet at the same time, we're not going to dilly-dally either. So plan on moving right along. So with that, we will conclude our meeting for today, setting the bill aside to readdress on Wednesday. Next meeting will be Wednesday at 3:30, as usual. We're going to start out with the consideration of governor's appointee, a man named Mike Picaro, being appointed to the Alaska Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, and then we're going to proceed again with House Bill 50. So at this time, the meeting is adjourned. Let the record reflect. The time is 5:05 p.m.